Please rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Bentley, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Judge Renee Werke presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Go ahead and take a seat, please. And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have an oral argument calendar as well as a non-oral proceeding today, October 17, 2024. I'm going to make some preliminary remarks. You've been here before. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your case in chief. Respond, appellate counsel, I'm sorry. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. A reminder, the podium has a button on the lower right-hand side if you want to adjust it for your height convenience. Please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your case presentation. Our marshal joining us today is Mike McCauley, and I'm going to ask Mr. McCauley to call the first case for consideration.
Calling 824-0713, in re, the matter of the application of McConnon Tulu and Tedelec and Gouda to register the title to certain land.
And appellate counsel on the
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Sarah Tyson and I represent the appellants in this matter. Mr. Tulu, one of the appellants, is also here today. As the court is aware from the briefs, this case is primarily a dispute over approximately 12 inches of Mr. Tulu's driveway. Mr. Shermers and Mr. Tulu live in neighboring houses in Minneapolis. Mr. Tulu's driveway is between the parties' houses, right on the southern edge of Mr. Tulu's property. The driveway goes in a straight line from the street to Mr. Tulu's detached garage at the back of his lot. Now, Mr. Tulu's driveway is very old. The driveway has been there for decades, possibly even a century at this point. We know the house was built in 1915, so it's possible the driveway is also that old. No one looking at this driveway and no one living in this property and using this driveway would have any reason to believe that the boundary wasn't along the edge of Mr. Tulu's driveway. As a matter of common sense and common practice, people don't build their driveways on their neighbors' properties. They put them on the edge of their own land. And as the evidence at trial in this matter confirmed, until 2020, everyone acted as though the boundary between the parties' properties did indeed run along the edge of Mr. Tulu's driveway. Mr. Tulu had no idea that the edge of his driveway was not the boundary. He believed, and he acted as though he owned every bit of that driveway, and Mr. Shermers likewise acted as though the boundary was along the edge of Mr. Tulu's driveway. In 2020, however, the trench was not there. When are you asking about with regard to the trench?
Well, that's a good portion of the 12 inches.
Yes. So Mr. Shermer's trench existed in the same location that it is now, which is on Mr. Shermer's side of the driveway boundary line. Mr. Tulu's trench was put in after that, in 2020, I believe.
But isn't that the crux of what your problem is with this case? What detriment did Mr. Tulu have as far as the trench is concerned? Because the improvements, what he constructed, wasn't within or made on the boundary line that's in dispute now, was it?
Yes. The cement trench itself is on the over the platted boundary line.
According to the survey?
Yes.
So you're conceding the survey is accurate?
Yes. That is the platted boundary line.
And that's the north line of the corner's property?
Yes, I believe. So I'm not great at north and south, but yes, it's the line between Mr. Shermer's and Mr. Tulu's properties. Now in 2020, Mr. Shermer's became increasingly upset with Mr. Tulu over a disruption that was caused by some of Mr. Tulu's improvements to his house and his yard. So in July 2020, Mr. Shermer's had the surveyors come out and put in the markers along that platted boundary that we just discussed. and that's about a foot to the north of the driveway edge. Mr. Schirmers has since demanded that Mr. Tulu remove the part of his driveway that's on Mr. Schirmers' side of the platted line, and also remove the concrete drainage trench that also, as we discussed, slightly encroaches over the line. The doctrine of practical location of boundaries exists for exactly these types of circumstances. Practical location is a longstanding, well-established doctrine under Minnesota law. It applies even to Torrens property like Mr. Schirmers. And the basic principle underlying the doctrine is that when adjoining landowners recognize a particular practical boundary line between their properties and then consistently treat that particular line as the boundary, they can't turn around decades later and claim a different line.
Can I ask you about that, the party's practices? And sorry, I want to make sure, is the mic...
First of all, I just want to point out that there are two different grounds for practical location boundaries that do apply here. One is acquiescence, and the other is estoppel. And acquiescence is primarily the grounds that requires you to show that the parties consented to the boundary at the location of the practical line. Now, with regard to your question, which is the evidence showing that they did indeed acquiesce to that line, I think there are a number of things that were established at trial. The first is that for as long as anyone can remember, until 2020, Mr. Schirmers has treated the entire driveway as Mr. Tulu's or his predecessor, Mr. Price's, driveway. He never once in all... Sure. I think, first, with respect to the rosebush, I would agree that that is something of a fact question. But I think, you know, the bush wasn't planted on Mr. Tulu's side of the line. It overhung. And these are Minneapolis lots. They're close together. I don't think, you know, it's a clear showing that just because he planted this bush and it happened to hang over this driveway, that he was somehow not agreeing that this driveway, part of this driveway, belonged to him. And to the contrary, all of his conduct up until 2020 was that the entire driveway did belong to Mr. Tulu and Mr. Price before him. Now, I do want to mention... That's true, and that's where Mr. Price's, his conduct with regard to Mr. Price comes in. Now, Mr. Price did use the driveway since Mr. Schirmers moved in 1991. And this is an area where I think the district court's findings do exhibit some clear error, because the district court found that Mr. Price didn't use the part of the driveway that encroaches over the line. And I just don't think that's believable based on all of the other evidence that was presented at trial and just common sense understanding the nature of these lots. It's a very narrow driveway. I agree, and I do think that it is in this case. He did testify that Mr. Price parked his car on this driveway in the front part of it, and he makes a big deal about the fact that it was just the front part, but I don't think that's relevant because the entire driveway encroaches, right? It's a line that goes straight back. Every part of that driveway, including the front, includes a bit that encroaches on Mr. Schirmer's property. Nevertheless, Mr. Price parked his car regularly for years on that part of the driveway, and Mr. Schirmer's testified and agreed that he never said anything to Mr. Price about it, never suggested that he was using his driveway or that he was giving him permission to use the driveway. It was just known and accepted, and everyone recognized that the driveway was Mr. Price's, that the boundary ran along the edge of it. Now, I do want to briefly go back to the stake, because I do think that's important, and I think the district court's treatment of the stake and its significance is fairly cursory, and it's important to this case. So with regard to practical location by estoppel, one of the elements is that the party who is going to be estopped knew about the true location of the boundary. And that element was established here because of the stake. So Mr. Schirmer testified and conceded that very shortly after he moved into the property, Mr. Price pointed out the stake to him and told him that it was a property boundary, that it marked the property line. Well, that's what Mr. Schirmer's asserts, that because it wasn't marked, he didn't necessarily know that it was a survey marker. And I don't think that's credible, because if you look at his conduct in this case, he very clearly understood that it was a survey marker, and he acted as if it were. And he testified in this case that the... Well, that it marked the boundary line and had significance because of that. And I would say that...
It sounds like it marked what the parties at some point in time thought approximately was the place where the monument should be, but it doesn't sound like it was a monument.
Well, I think if you look at where the stake was, and we have photos and exhibits that show where the stake was, it's where the platted boundary line is. And so we have that evidence that it is indeed on the boundary line. You can. There are the surveys that were produced in this case by both parties. So we do have the diagram showing sort of the layout of the parties' properties and where all their different features were. By the time that the surveys were made, the stake had been removed, and that's crucial, I would say, because the reason that Mr. Schirmer's got the survey was because the stake had been removed, and that I think shows that he understood that it was significant. He testified that when Mr. Tulu's contractors removed the stake, and that wasn't a big deal to Mr. Tulu because Mr. Tulu didn't think it had any meaning, right? He thought the driveway edge was along that border of the driveway. This was just a stake in the ground. And Mr. Schirmer's knew that it had significance. So when Mr. Tulu's contractors took that stake out, Mr. Schirmer's got upset. And he testified that that's the reason he went and got the line remarked based on the survey and put those survey markers along Mr. Tulu's driveway and his trench.
So are your arguments in the alternative? Because it seems like that, so I guess the question is, which is it? Either he knew that the property line was at the stake line, which then seems to, would, you know, render your acquiescence argument, would rule out the acquiescence, right? Because otherwise, that as a factual basis. So I'm wondering, are you arguing those in the alternative? And what is the best reading of the record here? Which is it? Did he know or did he not? Or what? I'm just trying to understand your position.
They're not necessarily in the alternative. You have to show that the party knew where or had knowledge of the true line to establish estoppel. You can, but don't have to show that the party knew of the true line for acquiescence. So to establish acquiescence, you can show that the party knew the true line but still acquiesced for the requisite 15 years in engaging in conduct that evidenced assent to that boundary line, whether or not they knew of the true boundary line. So they're not in the alternative, and we do think both apply here because Mr. Schirmer's did have knowledge but also acquiesced.
What's the strongest factor that you say demonstrates Schirmer's knowledge?
The stake, and I think the importance that he put in the stake. He was very upset when it was removed. He always referred to it as a survey stake. In the related proceeding between the parties before this, the district court referred to it as a survey stake. I think this idea that, you know, he had no idea of the significance, it was just a pole in the ground, is really sort of a post hoc fiction to avoid application of estoppel. But I think if you actually look at the record, he very clearly understood the significance of the stake. He was upset when it was removed. It spurred him to get the survey. I think he clearly had knowledge of the true line. And he also clearly had knowledge that Mr. Tulu was making significant improvements onto his lot, including some that were related to or around the line, or at least that would have been affected.
Well, as we've said, the only improvement was a trench that has to do with being on or around. I mean, you've got other things in your briefing, in your file, but that has to do with the house, which is, you'd certainly concede that that was not related to the boundary line.
I concede that buying the house itself would not be an improvement that you could rely on to establish estoppel. But what I would argue is that the improvements don't have to be directly on the line. And we do have some improvements
here.
Authority?
Can you cite? I don't know that you've cited any authority that we can say, gee, all the stuff you did in the house has to be attributable to the boundary line in dispute.
Sure. So Jalal v. Koss, I believe, is the case that we cite. And that's a non-precedent decision from this court where practical location by estoppel was affirmed based on the fact that the party had testified that they would not have put their house and retaining wall as close to the line if they knew where the true line was. It was still on their property, but they testified that we wouldn't have, you know, made these changes, put this where it was near the line if we had known about the line.
But you're not putting the roof there. The roof's already
there. This is true, but I...
You're
yes. First of all, there were also improvements around the garage and on the other side of the driveway. Now, if you agree that the driveway is not all Mr. Tulu's, and what Mr. Shermer wants to force Mr. Tulu to do is to remove the driveway and put it further in on his property. That work that he did replacing paving tiles on his side of the driveway, and the work that he did on the garage, which, by the way, cannot be accessed if this driveway is narrowed anymore, are useless. I mean, he doesn't need to improve his garage to store cars and other items that he can't get back there because he has no access from the street.
And Ms. Tyson, your time has expired, but please answer Judge Kirk's question.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, you can answer the question.
Oh. Yes, the stoop has been a subject of debate among the parties. There are certain city regulations relating to the houses and the certain exits, and they discuss the regulations a little bit in the trial testimony because these are, or at least have been categorized as like multi-dwelling units. So there are a lot of regulations about where they can put, you know, exits and entrances, and so there's been
some... But you already have an entrance on the back, don't you? That could substitute for the one on the side? Am I wrong?
The question is whether or not he actually can just use the back door. It's not clear that that's something that he would be able to do and still comply with the various zoning regulations and so forth.
But it exists, right?
The back door?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And you'll have your 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. We'll hear from Respondent Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Keith Mollebon, and I represent the respondent, Greg Shermers. So we're dealing here with registered property. The property line, the north property line of the Shermers property is registered. The appellant's property is abstract. So we're at a very heightened standard of review here. For them to prevail and to move a registered property line, they have to have evidence that is clear, positive, and unequivocal. They had their day in court. We had tried this case back in January. They were able to submit all the evidence they wanted. The title examiner wrote a very detailed and thorough opinion and made factual findings to which this court needs to defer, and they are well supported in the record.
Well, counsel, just assume, for the sake of argument, that we agree with you and we say the line should stay where it was. What are you going to do if they don't remove the driveway?
What is my client going to do?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Just more
what
litigation.
My client is concerned about right now is that the property that he owns, that he has registered a title on, that a mortgage is attached to, that he's been using
so
for 30 years.
So essentially you'll have boundaries established, but then the problem will still remain with your client as to enforcement of that order should we rule in your favor.
Well, the boundary is established. The case here is about moving the boundary at their request.
Right.
So if the court...
The boundary determination.
If the boundary is left where it is, then the status quo remains as it is. And they're not the greatest of neighbors, and they're going to maybe have some issues. But the question before this court is that do they have a legal basis to move the line based on clear, positive, and unequivocal evidence? And they just don't come anywhere close to that.
So you would have to be very careful, though, too, if you're going to use a jackhammer or a cement saw or whatever to take out that part of their driveway and trench that you claim is on your property. You'd have to be pretty precise, and you'd have to hire a fairly good concrete person to do that.
Or alternatively, bring a motion to compel and have somebody force the other party to make that removal. I mean, it just seems to us that this case has a myriad of after-the-fact consequences that this court certainly is not resolving for you today.
Well, we know it is in the record that that the appellants intend to repave and replace the driveway. They've done other renovations. When they do that, presumably they'll have it only on their property. And if they do make the adjustment on the step, which is very much possible for them, then they can start using this concrete surface as a driveway. The reality is, for the vast majority of what anyone knows about this property, this concrete surface has not been used by anyone as a driveway. So getting to the legal questions here, so the first one is, and I do want to give you some orientation about the property, this concrete surface does not extend the full property line. So the trench, Judge Kirk, that you're talking about is between the garages. And so one of the overreaches that we have here is not only are they trying to take property along the area of this concrete surface, but they also want to take property where they built a trench on my client's property without permission. And I will correct counsel on the record as far as the reason for getting the survey was because of this trench. It wasn't because of the removal of that pipe. So when we look at the first issue, which is their estoppel claim, so they have to have proof that my client had knowledge of the true property line, and there just is no such proof as the title examiner found. There was no survey in place. There were no actual survey markers in place. This was a steel metal pipe. There's a photo of it, which is all we have today because the appellants destroyed that evidence. But we have a single pipe in one place, and one of the things that the title examiner found, which makes perfect sense, is you need 2 points to make a line. So the notion that this pipe somehow denoted a property line just is physically can't be true because it would have to be connected to some other set of markers that would then establish a line. So that's the first problem there. The second problem is nobody knows why that pipe was put there. There's no evidence in the record that it was ever intended by anyone to be a property marker. Now, what we do have is a hearsay statement that was admitted for a very limited purpose over our objection, and it's important because in their opening brief, they rely heavily on this hearsay statement, and in their reply, after we point out that it wasn't offered for the truth, then they back off and say, well, we're not really relying on it. But as you just heard in the argument, they're trying to say that because the prior owner, Mr. Preuss, some 30 years ago, out of court, told my client that's a property marker, that hearsay statement could be relied upon as proof of the truth of the matter, which is it was on the property line. When I objected to that at trial, counsel said, oh, no, we're not offering it for the truth. We're offering it for the effect on the listener, at which time I said, well, then that's irrelevant because the effect on the listener is not what you have to prove. What you have to prove is that he knew where the actual property line is. So the pipe gets them nowhere on the issue of where was the actual property line. For all these reasons, no one knows why it was put there. It was a hearsay statement at best. At best, if you even have credit what Mr. Preuss said, all that was that he thought it was a property line in that one point, of course, not knowing in any other direction where it went.
And on that point, of course, we don't go back and reweigh the examiner's determination as to the relevancy.
Yeah, I don't think they even appealed the evidentiary issue. I don't think, because that was their own decision to offer it for not for the for the truth, and it wouldn't have come in otherwise. It wouldn't have properly come in otherwise. But the bottom line is one pipe of unknown origin in one place on the property cannot establish that my client knew where the true property line is. His testimony was he didn't know where the property line was until they did the survey in 2020. The court found that to be credible, and that's a finding that I think this court has to defer to. So on estoppel, they just don't have evidence of proof of where the property line. And then this detriment issue is another one that I understand your questions. There was no improvement along the area of this concrete surface. The one thing that they did that was anywhere near a property line was this trench. And that couldn't have been in reliance on anything that my client told them about the concrete surface or anything that he knew, because it wasn't even anywhere near this concrete surface. What they call the driveway runs for a certain extent straight, and then it curves off into their property to get to the garage. So there is a section in the backside of the property that isn't even, no one's contending that the property line is anywhere near the concrete surface or driveway. So again, the knowledge of the property line, the title examiner properly found that there wasn't any of that. And then the detriment, you know, the one case where the Supreme Court, looked at this estoppel argument was the Halverson case, which was pretty egregious. The city had given approval for someone to move property, move buildings and onto this property when the city knew that it was not his property, allowed him then to improve the buildings that were built on the disputed area, and then later tried to say, well, that's actually the city's property, and the court, that was a pretty clear estoppel case. We don't really have that here. The appellant's argument at trial was, I wouldn't have bought this property if I knew that the line was here, but of course my client had nothing to do with the decision to buy the property. And as you readily point out, there were no improvements made to this concrete surface or anything in that area. So they're both elements of the estoppel claim. You don't get anywhere close to clear, positive, and unequivocal evidence to support the estoppel claim. So then we talk about the acquiescence claim. So you have to have acquiescence in a feature on the property that both parties agree is a property line for 15 years. So we know that anything that the appellants could say about conduct could not meet the 15 years, because as you pointed out, they bought the property in 2008. We objected once we got the survey and asked for the encumbrance to be removed in 2020. That's 12 years. So for them to prove acquiescence, they have to show that...
Just a clarifying question on that point. Is it your position then that the actual parties to the dispute have to have acquiesced for 15 years, or could there ever be a scenario where a prior owner plays into that 15-year period? So I think the argument is that maybe these parties were there for only 12 years, but that the Mr. Preuss, you said before, you know, had acquiesced for at least 3 years before that. So I'm just trying to understand, is that a legal distinction or is it a factual question?
It's a legal distinction, and it's also a factual finding that doesn't support their claim. I've tried to break it down into two pieces, because a lot of what they say is, well, someone put a ladder on the concrete surface in 2020, or, you know, Mr. Shermers was upset about something in 2020. I want to make clear that anything in that era really can't meet their burden. But as to this driveway concrete surface being a property marker, the law is that you have to have intended, you have to build that, you have to put that in place with the intent that it be a property marker. So, for example, in the Wojan case, which is the Minnesota Supreme Court, they say one of the most important factors is whether the parties attempted and intended to place the fence as near the dividing line as possible. So on these acquiescence cases, what you're looking for is evidence that not just that there was some feature on the property that, you know, at this point in time someone wants to say is a property line. You have to find that the parties treated it, intended this feature to be a property line. That's what Wojan says. In the Pratt case, which both parties cite, but really it completely supports our view of it here, is that you have to have, I mean, they sort of run through the cases, and the Pratt case is, nor is there acquiescence when landowners erect markers or physical barriers that are not intended to identify boundaries. And then they say, they cite cases, and the title examiner cited these cases where this wasn't an acquiescence case because it was, this feature was not intended to be a property line. So then we look at this concrete surface. The title examiner properly found, nobody knows why this driveway concrete surface was built where it was. It could have been 100 years ago, we don't know, but there was no evidence in the record to say, yeah, when we put this driveway in, we wanted this edge of the driveway to be a property line.
Do you think they couldn't, are you arguing that they couldn't have, and I understand these are not the facts of this case, but just to understand your position, that the concrete driveway is there, has been there for many years, with or without an intention of moving the property line. But could they have said to each other 15 years ago, you know what, this is now going to be our property line. You go ahead and use the rest of those few feet. So, in other words, do they need to intend, like, to put, to build the markers for the purpose of moving the line, or isn't it all about the intent of the parties in the end? And you're looking at what was it that they were doing?
Yeah.
And you could show prove intent by different means than just building a fence.
Well, the cases, Pratt, Wojohn, the cases that deal with this are usually dealing with a situation where someone is saying, we built this, and someone wants to contend they built it as a property line. The facts of this case just don't get anywhere close to what you're talking about, because there's just no evidence in the record that it was built to be a property boundary, that Mr. Preuss or Mr. Shermer's ever talked about it being a property line. The evidence is undisputed that these parties never discussed where the property line was between their properties until the survey was done. So we could surmise another case, but the facts of this case just don't get anywhere close. But again, we're talking about clear, positive, and unequivocal evidence that these parties intended for the edge of this driveway to be a property line at any point in time. You don't have anyone saying that or discussing that. And that's why, again, when you look at acquiescence as one of their claims, for 15 years, they just didn't get anywhere close to the standard, which is why title examiner properly decided this case, and you should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mohepin. And Ms. Tyson, you have the last word.
Thank you. Just a couple of things that I do want to address. First, to establish practical location by estoppel, you have to show knowledge of the true boundary line. I think that's established here by the fact that the survey marker was where it was, and Mr. Shermer...
You're talking about the photo of the survey marker.
Yes. We know that it was there because of the photo and because Mr. Shermer's testified that it was there.
About the examiner finding credibility as far as Shermer's testimony that he didn't know.
I find that unreliable and confusing because Shermer's contradicts his own testimony. I mean, first he says, yeah, I knew this was a survey, or I thought this was a survey marker. He told me it was a survey marker. And contrary to what counsel said, he did testify that, he specifically said, that is Mr. Shermer's, talked to him, Mr. Tulu, about the fact that there had been a survey marker somewhere in here, and I no longer knew where it was because it was discarded when he had the contractor excavate this whole area. So he understands at this point that it's a survey marker, and this whole, well, maybe he didn't know, is really just a post hoc trying to avoid that fact.
But if the marker's no longer there, how do we know where it was?
We have the photograph showing where it was.
Yeah, but...
Quite a few photographs.
Yeah, angles of photos can show a lot of things.
I think that's true, but I don't think it's that hard if you actually look at the exhibits to see where it lines up with the driveway, and you can compare that to the surveys that were also submitted as exhibits to see sort of where the features are in the parties' homes. I think it's fairly easy to discern where the survey marker was based on those two exhibits.
But it wasn't in the corner of the lot where a monument normally would be.
No. That said, it doesn't have to be an official survey marker to show that Shermer's knew where the line was. Now, I also want to briefly address that Mr. Mohiban did mention that, you know, if you affirm the district court here, that the parties will just continue in status quo, and I don't think that's true, because the status quo, for as long as Mr. Tulu has lived in his house, and really as long as Mr. Price lived in the house before him, has been that Mr. Tulu used the full width of the driveway. He understood it was his driveway, and changing that now is not maintaining the status quo. And that leads to one other point that I wanted to make, which is that Mr. Mohiban again stated that the driveway had never been used as a driveway, that it wasn't used to bring vehicles back to the backside of the house. And again, that's also not true. And there was a related case in this matter, which is mentioned in the reply brief, where the district court did find that Mr. Tulu's workers had used the driveway as a driveway. And when they did that, they strayed over the line of the driveway onto Mr. Price's or Mr. Shermer's property. He was upset about that. It caused some minor damage to his side of the driveway, and that was a big feature of the first case between the parties. So it's inconsistent for him now to say, well, they never used this as a driveway, they didn't use the full width. You know, they did, and it caused problems between the parties. That was part of it.
Wasn't the first case, though, related to water drainage as a result of?
Yes, that was one of the issues. Okay. But specifically that he had changed aspects of his property that had allegedly caused water to run off onto Mr. Shermer's property. The district court found that that was mostly not true. But one of the things that she did find was that, again, the workers had been using the driveway as a driveway, and because it's a very narrow driveway, they had sometimes gone over the edge onto what Mr. Shermer has always said is his property, and that that had caused the trespass claim that ultimately Mr. Tulu did end up paying a small amount of money for. But again, that's just not consistent with what he claims now.
Grand though.
I think slightly, but certainly not the full, like, $10,000 that he had been asking for in that other claim. I did also briefly want to mention that it's discussed quite extensively in the briefs, but, you know, one of the problems that I think Mr. Mohiban does highlight is that the district court treated this idea that the parties had to, or that Mr. Tulu had to prove that the parties installed this driveway with the intent that it marked the boundary line. And I just don't think that's an element of the claim. The claim to establish acquiescence is that you need to establish that the parties, you know, assented to a boundary line in a particular place for the requisite 15 years. Now, that might be established if you can show that the fence or whatever else they put up because they believed it was the boundary. But you can also show it other ways, like that the parties acted for that 15 years like it was the boundary. And so I think the district court made the same mistake that Mr. Mohiban does, where they added that as a sort of required element to the claim, and it's just not a required element. It's a factor. You can consider it, but it's not decisive. So for those reasons, we do request that the court reverse the district court and either remand for factual findings based on the correct legal standard or find that practical location by estoppel was established and direct entry of registration of the border along the practical boundary. Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys for appearing today in support of your clients' respective matters. The matters are submitted. A decision will be issued in the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you.